Hello and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm Chairman Emeritus of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Club and your host for today. Our program today is the Intergalactic Design Guide, a quantum approach for human and business potential with Cheryl Heller. Cheryl is the founding chair, MFA in Design for Social Innovation at the School of Visual Arts, or SVA, in New York City, and the founder of CommonWise. So with that, I'd like to introduce Cheryl Heller.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you all for inviting me here and for coming. Human beings are pretty amazing, aren't we? Definitely at the top of the food chain, the smartest species with brain cells beyond what we know how to use. We've built urban centers, energy, infrastructure, transportation, and food systems. We've built industry to fill the millions of offices. Cities are spreading and growing across the planet. More people have access than ever before. Technologies created a vast intelligence network. We make anything we can imagine. Prosthesis that can sense things and move like human limbs, robots that are getting more like human beings all the time, computers on our wrists, driverless cars, assault rifles. There's nothing we can't make. It's really cool. Design is how all these things are created. Design is what makes the things we all want. And design makes us want all those things. Design fills the vast shelves of Costco with billions of choices for things to buy. It forms and colors and packages food to look irresistible, from orange cheese curls to blue gummy bears or red velvet cupcakes. Design makes objects desirable, even when they do nothing but sit on a shelf and look pretty. Design separates luxury from trash. It defines value and status. We're pretty proud of ourselves, and we should be. Except here's the thing. Here's a bigger perspective on what we are creating from one of the most articulate environmental writers today, David Orr. As Homo sapiens' entry into any intergalactic design competition, industrial civilization would be tossed out of the qualifying round. It doesn't fit. It won't last. The scale is wrong, and even its apologists admit that it's not very pretty. The design failures of industrially, technologically driven societies are manifest in the loss of diversity of all kinds, destabilization of the Earth's biogeochemical cycles, pollution, soil erosion, ugliness, poverty, injustice, social decay, and economic instability. I would add racism and misogyny to that. So it's amazing what a fresh perspective can do to your view of things, right? If you step back from our daily lives in the middle of what we created, surrounded by the things that consume us and the things that we consume, to look objectively as an outsider with a wider vision might. That David Orr quote is the inspiration for the book I'm writing, The Intergalactic Design Guide, and the book is a culmination of decades of work in social design. In writing it, I'm looking for a new perspective on how and what we design, one that will work for us in the big picture and over the long term. We're all looking for a way to increase human potential and creativity, not to design more things in an attempt to solve the big problem, but using design to fix the social architecture that connects or disconnects us from each other, from the earth, and from everything around us, including our technology and our things. We're looking for a way that will make businesses more vital, governments more effective, and society stronger because we're connected to each other. And it's the connection that we all seek, not connectivity to more technology, but connection between each other and the planet. And we're all hoping we can do that in a way that will win the next intergalactic design competition, which would mean design that's elegant and sustainable and just and generative. So in other words, if we think of design as a tool, I'm talking about using the same tool we use to screw ourselves to unscrew us. To do that requires a major shift in thinking, and it's based on a notion that's simple to understand, but really hard to do. And it is designing for relationships instead of only things. It means designing an underlying social architecture that supports and encourages the conditions for our success. And that means designing what's invisible, designing not with the typical physical materials or bits and bytes that we use, but designing with things that we have to sense and feel because we can't see them. There are lots of names for this. People call it human-centered design. People call it design thinking. We call it social design because it focuses on the design of our connected society. And it makes sense for a number of reasons. Number one, it's quantum. It's how the universe works, right? In quantum mechanics, we learn that the relationship between things determine the nature of the things themselves. It's hard for us to grasp. But our world is moving from fixed to fluid, from analog to digital, from parts to systems. From Newtonian physics and our stuckness in noun and labels and fixed ideas. And this parallels the transition we've seen from an analog world to a digital fluid one, where everything is in relationship with something else. And from believing that in the industrial society that we could break the world up into parts in order to tame them, to knowing that everything is connected into huge complex systems, and that every single thing we touch affects something else. Our problems come in complex systems now, and a system is made of relationships between things. So poverty is connected to environmental degradation, jobs are connected to mental health, food to cancer and diabetes, health to government bureaucracies, food conglomerates to fuel for cars, pesticides to the collapse of bees, light pollution to the reduction of migrating birds, and climate change to everything. And that could go on for as long as we have time. So the idea that we spend as much time as we do worrying about the lack of headphone jack on the iPhone 7 is kind of extraordinary, really. Or how many followers we have on Twitter, or whether our laundry and our teeth are white enough. And yet we do. We do every day. If you want to test this theory, think about whether it's the things you own that make you who you are, or the relationships that you have with other people in your life and your work. I think it's the relationships that we have that form us, not the things we own. We can look at a few examples and try to extract some lessons from the principles that they illustrate. Some of these cases are for-profit businesses, and some are social organizations, but each one has relevance to every aspect of life, and they are working to solve problems that ensure that life continues. During the Kenyan elections of 2008, politicians used text messages to incite violence. They spread inflammatory lies and rumors across the country. The violence was widespread and bloody and ugly. In 2009, a woman named Rachel Brown founded Sisi Ni Amani, which means "We Are Peace" in Swahili. And she used the relationships between grassroots leaders and their network, using the same mobile messaging technology that incited violence, building an infrastructure of messages to diffuse it and incite peace. So she took local community leaders of, I don't know if you would call them gangs, but these small communities, and she created peace builders out of them who used their social capital in their communities to mobilize thousands of new subscribers who monitored tension and potential conflict, and countered propaganda and lies, and had trusted voices in the community to get to people before, to get them to think before they acted, and to bring calm. So as Kenyans went to the polls in the next election, and the votes were tallied, the activists sent out hundreds of thousands of SMS that disrupted the messages of violence and hate. Research from the Annenberg Institution at the University of Pennsylvania found that the program was very effective. People found them useful, said they had a positive effect in keeping peace, and convinced them not to believe in rumors. And people on the ground were really moved by this program. So traditional mass communication is disconnected and random, even when social media is used. But Sisi and Amani and Rachel's program, the communication was designed. It was specific and intentional, and it was built upon the existing trust and connection among the affected communities. So we think it's a brilliant design worthy of an intergalactic award. Michael Murphy is a Harvard-trained architect who was bothered by the footprint of architecture, by big famous architects getting a commission, creating their vision, building it into place, bringing in materials, bringing in workers, and leaving, and sort of hoping the town liked whatever was there, but pretty much leaving the community out of the process of building. Typically, buildings involve clients or commissioners, the architect's vision, the budget, the ROI, the efficiency in time and materials. When they're environmentally sound, they have a point of view on energy use, and they work towards that. But it's really, it's any place and every place according to generic standards. So what Michael did, Michael and his partners at his company called Mass Design, they tried to rethink the whole process of how an architect works. So in Rwanda, they reimagined the design of the hospital to have better ventilation, to bring in fresh air, which prevented people from getting sicker in the hospital than they were when they came in from airborne diseases. So it was designed in that sense to make people healthy. But they also, they flipped the accepted structure where patients all have their heads to the outside wall and their feet into the middle of the room, which made it easy for doctors to go up and down the hallway. Only had to make one walk to see all the patients. And they turned the patients around so they were looking outside, and the doctor had to walk around in a circle. But they found that people got better faster when they could see nature outside. They use only local materials, local labor, traditional building techniques, and they train workers. And sometimes they'll do research on traditional techniques in a location where they are that people actually haven't known or don't know how to do anymore. So they build environments through this process that are a source of beauty and pride for the community. So this designing is an architecture of relationships. It's bigger than the building that gets built, and it looks at the whole system. So the cultural relevance, the local workers and whether they get jobs from it, traditional craft, and the environmental footprint developed in an entirely different way. Leads to hospitals that make an entire community healthy, which was part of Michael's mission going in. Another man, Paul Pollack, who is a very dear friend of ours, is the best instinctive designer I know, and maybe the best ever. He pioneered human-centered design before anybody coined the term for it. He's a shrink who went to Somalia and decided to use some of his techniques for contextual treatment of patients on people who were poor. And so he's interviewed in his life 3,000 poor people, and he says he always asks them why they're poor, and they always know. And the answer is often, we don't have enough money. And they know they don't have enough money because they can't grow cash crops in the dry season. I mean, they know what it is, and they know how to help them. And so Paul has really been at the forefront of this notion of collaborating and co-creating with the societies where he's working. So one of his latest initiatives is called Spring Health. He's developed a water purifier that costs about 5 cents, and he's using that to do what he always does, which is to develop markets and economies in places where they don't exist yet. So he knew that having a affordable water filter was just the beginning, right? Because until it becomes embedded in the social architecture of the community, it doesn't do any good, as we've seen lots of inventions be put aside and not used by the people they're intended for. So what he did, he found these small retailers, the Keralas in India, that sell single portion shampoo or laundry soap, because that's all people can afford at one time. And he turned them into retailers of this clean water. He trained local workers to do the purification, to package and sell it and deliver it, creating jobs and income while solving the water problem. He experimented and continues to experiment with the best way to deliver water and how to convince people that this investment in clean water is a sound one. He prototypes continually, testing approaches to scaling he tests street theater groups who walk down the street who created plays and talk about why clean water is important. He tests that against people who go to door to door and offer to test people's water for free so they can see the things swimming in it. And what he's learned in this is how different ages and generations adopt or reject changing their drinking habits. Women react differently than men. That how long it takes for a woman to come to the door and answer when water's being delivered is the difference between a sustainable business financially and an unsustainable one. And none of these things can be known in advance because they involve human relationships in a constant motion. And so this is another example of designing for relationships as opposed to focusing just on the invention of a water filter. So a 5-cent water filter becomes a catalyst for this transformation of the community through human relationships. And the point here is that seeing and listening and being on the ground when you're dealing with relationships always wins because relationships can't be controlled or known in advance. This is a guy named Josh Trehoff, who was in the very first graduating class of my master's program. And he walked in with, I don't know how else to say it, a bug up his butt about food waste. He would stare down somebody who left half a lettuce leaf on their plate. He made everybody compost. He was like the vigilante for wasting food. And for a couple of years in the program, he struggled to try to figure out what to do about that. He'd tried to start a composting business. He had all kinds of ideas. And what he ended up with has been really interesting and a perfect example of this notion of designing for relationships. And in this case, what he's been able to redesign is the way people's relationship to what they eat and serve and sell. So Josh learned that you can't tell people not to throw food away. You can't shame them. But what bothered him was the big fact that, according to the NRDC, getting food from the farm to our fork eats up 10% of the total U.S. energy budget, uses 50% of U.S. land, swallows 80% of all fresh water consumed in the United States, and yet 40% of food goes uneaten. So here's one guy taking on that problem. What he did was find a chef, and they started something called Salvage Supper Club. They would scout green markets. They went to bruised boxes of grocery stores, food co-ops, restaurants, hotels, farms. They went everywhere. And they collected the things that are absolutely edible. They collected bananas that were too ripe, peaches that were bruised, broccoli stems, etc. And so he started this pop-up restaurant, but he did it in a swept-out dumpster on the streets of Brooklyn. And so, to me, the brilliance of this is it's delightful, right? It takes something that, you know, you're telling somebody to eat their not only eat their carrots, but eat their brown carrots. And because he did it in a dumpster, and because he made it so beautiful, they had tea lights, they had a very fancy meal, the chef was wonderful, and so people had these gourmet meals. And it's now spread to Japan, and to San Francisco. There were a couple of things out here. There are films about him on Discovery Channel. And for us, one of the exciting things was two of the big chefs in New York, Mario Batali and Dan Barber, announced months after Josh did this that they were opening restaurants serving food that was diverted from landfill. Some people call it ugly food. You know, it's the apples that are misshapen and nobody wants to eat them. But again, you think about this, right? So the typical way we approach things is, okay, I'm going to open a restaurant and I'm going to serve this food. And in that case, you'd think about location and you'd think about, you know, menu and you'd think about who your customers were going to be. And that would have been a pretty direct process. But because Josh was looking to change people's behavior and change their relationship with food, he designed for those relationships in involving the farmers and involving everyone in the food industry and even the people who owned the dumpsters were so excited about this that they started offering him dumpsters free because they were getting all this press. This was in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, HuffPost. It's been written up all over the world. And another example of the same kind of design for relationships, and this one's interesting. So Eric Herzman is a serial entrepreneur in Africa. He wants to have the first billion-dollar African company. This is for profit. Before he founded this company, Brick, he founded something called Ushahidi. Has anybody heard of that? Ushahidi was the first mobile to web connection. And so for the same Kenyan elections that were so, they were so worried about, a couple of friends over a weekend got together and figured out a way for people to send a text message about what was happening wherever they were, and it appeared on a website. So these maps were created. Since then, Ushahidi's been used in 40 countries. It was used to save people after the Haiti earthquake, and it's been used for disaster relief. People also use it just to form communities who like to crochet. But anyway, so it sort of completely changed the visibility for people who don't have internet access. So Eric has been pushing at this same idea of connectivity for people who aren't on the map yet. He also founded iHub, which is one of the most exciting and respected technology incubators in Kenya. But this last innovation called Brick is a rugged router that connects people in rural Africa who only have a cell phone, which is most of them, to the internet. So there was a while when he was calling it the last mile connection of the internet. It's made for this environment. He practiced dropping it on the floor, driving over it with his car, you know, drowning it, heating it. But the point is, it's based on deep knowledge of people's relationship to technology there. So in the same way that Paul uses relationships to shift behavior, to use these products, Eric is using the social architecture of rural Africa. He's got stores and local gathering sites who use it so that multiple people can connect it. He uses it for education because it can download programming, so even if you lose your connection, it goes. So it is, you know, from the ground up, a connection to the world. So we know big technologies are working to make the internet available to people everywhere. And that may work fine in developed countries where people have computers that they own or can share. But what Eric's done in Africa is to build an infrastructure that's both technological and social. So he's built a ground game so that there's actually ways for people to connect to this new access that's being offered. And the point there is that a ground game is about having relationships. So I said social design has been, if you look at the history of social innovation, people have been working at this from when there were first people, right? There have always been organizations that are trying to help underserved populations and bring justice. It's been about, I'd say, 10 years, maybe 12 years, that designers have gotten involved in this field, that people all over the world are looking at how to use the design methodology to facilitate those changes, that the notion of creating in collaboration with the people that you're trying to help have become a part of it. And because 5 years ago I launched this master's program in design for social innovation, I've been thinking about this for a long time, right? What is the responsibility? So We're looking to bring rigor to this field and to measure the difference that design actually makes. So one of the things we've done, which is free to everyone, is something called The Understatement. It's an online journal, Thoughts on the State and Practice of Social Design. Another thing we're doing is a symposium in January where we're bringing together people from all different fields, focusing on health, but from Gates Foundation, from Rockefeller Foundation, Robert Wood Johnson, from IBM. So it's the corporate world, the design world, the philanthropy world coming together to look at this thing that we're all doing and develop a way to understand it more fully and put it in a form and templates that other people can use for other things. If you are interested in learning to do it, or if you know someone, come back to school because these are the things I think today more than ever, that we heal our social connections and that we develop a society that makes human beings more prolific and more sustainable, and to get away from looking to things outside of ourselves to solve all the problems we have. And I thank you.
Our program today is the Intergalactic Design Guide, A Quantum Approach for Human and Business Potential. Our speaker is Cheryl Heller, founding chair MFA in Design for Social Innovation, School of Visual Arts in New York City, and the founder of CommonWise. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman emeritus of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Commonwealth Club. This is the Commonwealth Club of California, and now we are going to turn it over to our studio audience here at the club today for questions for Cheryl. Cheryl, I'm going to ask you the first question. How can, without coming to New York City to live and be in your school, how can we as people that know about design or we as people that don't know about design, how can we jump into this?
I talk all the time about, Pollock was really an important inspiration in my life, and I asked that same question at a point when I was working with big corporations all over the country and said, how do I take what I know how to do and use it for things I believe in? And he kept saying to me, just take the leap. And I would say, leap where? Leap to what? There's nothing there. There is a path now, right? And there are wonderful places in California where you can begin to study it. It's a new field. And so we're just beginning to put the steps together into one cohesive plan. But I would say, in the simplest terms, if you look into how you can support the things you believe in, and you pay attention to the human dynamics behind what's going on, you will have begun a more in-depth approach. Is to take classes on mapping systems, on game design, on ethnographic research. There are lots of places to learn these very core principles and approaches that are part of design.
Okay, we have a question up front.
This last election.
It is on.
This last election pointed out a major fallacy in our culture. That's groupthink. And there are two major groups, obviously, in our country. Who's going to deal with bridging that gap when the more knowledge people have, the dumber they get, actually, in this culture? Because the more knowledge they have, they tend to partition themselves off into groups that think like they do, instead of finding out and learning from groups that don't think like they do and growing the culture together. This country has become the divided states of America versus the United States of America.
What we're experiencing are things that the Middle East has experienced for a long time. They're issues that Israel and the Palestinians are dealing with. There are issues that people in Europe are dealing with, and there are approaches, but you have to be serious about doing that. So Rachel Brown, the woman I mentioned who did the program in Kenya, is now working in Europe, and she is working to try to understand how communication is being used by the far right. The neo-Nazis and other factions. She's being funded to look at how to diffuse hate. I don't pretend. I think we're all still reeling from the last election, and I don't.
That's my whole point. Smart.
Do we have any students here today that have a question? Yeah.
Hi, I wanted to know about some of the design tools and resources used in the education program.
Sure. So the first and the hardest is critical thinking. But it is, that is the essential element that gives people agency to believe they can reframe a problem, to believe or to understand how to see something from a different perspective, and define it differently. The tools are all kinds of research, ethnographic research, but other research techniques, communication design, game design, which we think is a really important component here, understanding how games work and how to use them in social situations. What didn't I say? We have programs in building movements, how to engage online communities. We have programs in entrepreneurship and collective leadership, which is a big part of it. You know, how do you lead when you know that no matter how strong you are, you will never be able to solve the problems on your own? And what is the dynamic of needing to work with multiple groups? And then the design process, but that's kind of interesting because the design process is baked into every part of the two-year program. It's not sort of taught as one program on itself. It's embedded in all the others. What's unique, I think, is that not only do we have students from 23 countries, but we have students from all backgrounds. So we've had economists and engineers and anthropologists, and that makes it really interesting because another core tenet is really understanding diversity and diversity of thought and using that. And also not being naive or egotistical about the fact that we're inventing any of this stuff, right? This is the creative process applied to problems that have existed to greater or lesser extents. And so one of the classes is taught by a woman who I call my favorite cynic, but she's done everything. You know, she's worked in the field. She founded the U.S. Division of WaterAid. She ran strategic development for the Museum of Natural History. And she's seen what works, right? I mean, when you're in the ground and people don't have clean water, the saying is giving them a glass of water doesn't help. But she teaches a class to familiarize people with what are the organizations out there and how do they work, right? Where are you going to find yourself when you're out there? So that history and that grounding and what the practice is really important.
Hi. I noticed a common theme of creating shared value. So how do you think us as designers can maybe influence businesses to reimagine their business models to have more social impact? And if that happens, is that a big risk or how can we go about that?
I think that's an age-old question, right? So it used to be asked just, how do I get a seat at the table in a corporation? And the answer is always the same, and the answer is about relationships, right? That you have to earn trust. So as a designer, you have to be willing to learn as much about that company's business as you do about your own, and to put yourself in their shoes, and to frame these opportunities in a way that actually benefits their business, right? It has to be not either or, but it has to be part of their central strategy. And if you do that and if you do the work, I'm still a designer, but, you know, I've been a designer for many years. Designers tend to be fairly myopic, you know. They like to hang around with other designers. And you need to immerse yourself in other worlds in order to be a designer in another world helping them. So I would say in terms of how do you know if it's right, if you have, if you've done due diligence to really understand what will benefit the company, then I think, you know, can you make mistakes? Of course. But number one, you'll be doing it in collaboration with them. And number two, you will have taken the time to know what you're doing.
Okay, we have one more question over here.
Yeah, hi, thanks. My name's Otis Paul. And as I walk around town, I see a lot of a very large institution here called the Academy of Art University. Are you affiliated with them or no? Do you know if they offer programs similar to what you do? And last, would there perhaps be a student in the audience who could explain more about that to her?
I do not know. I am from New York, and so I think anyone here would be better qualified to answer that than me.
Okay, well, that. So I think there are similar programs here. We can talk about that after the program today. So Cheryl, what would you say now would be, what are some of the tools that someone who's not a designer can take from the design world and apply to a social consciousness or an approach to social justice? Things that might not be understood by a non-designer, a designer might take for granted, but that a business person here today might not know about.
I think they're very similar to what designers use. I think it is, first of all, being aware of the tendency in business or in any big institution to sit in an office somewhere and decide what someone else needs. And even though, even when you are really aware of that tendency, it's very hard not to do it, because you come in from the outside and you say, they don't have nice houses. I know how to fix them up. So sort of stepping on that instinct to be the savior from outside, taking the time to actually talk to the people who you're trying to help, whoever they are. As I said, in the case of Paul, right, they generally know better than outsiders what's needed. So that's one thing. And another thing, and this is the hardest, for people who work in sort of outside the design field, and that is to be willing to not know the answer until you find out, right? I mean, I grew up, I've worked in consultancies, and I've worked with, we were taught to walk in and have the answer, right? In your first meeting, yeah, I know what you need, and I can, just leave this to me, and I can help it. That instinct is baked into us, right? But in fact, in the design process, you get to unusual solutions and you get to innovative solutions because you don't come in with one, because you come in and actually pay attention to what's going on. And then the third thing is the shift from a plan, a prescriptive plan for how something's going to work, to a process that depends on iterating, on prototyping something, on paying attention to what happened, on looking at what response that got, and then doing something else again. So there are three mindsets that are central, there are probably more, central to the design process, and they're very, very hard. They're very hard to shift to.
So I totally agree with what you just said, and it's been my experience as well. I'm wondering if you've seen examples of local governments, city councils, people, groups like that, being able to make that shift and to begin to operate differently, as opposed to coming in and saying they represent a particular interest or they have a particular solution. So again, the dynamics of politics makes that really difficult.
I've never seen a government do it on their own. I've seen it happen in Sierra Leone. That I worked on, it was part of a big grant looking at whether innovations could emerge from the places where maternal and infant health was worst. And it was, from the beginning, the policymakers and people from the government were included. And so they saw the process and saw the different results. I've seen it in Buffalo, New York. I work with the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus that is working. I mean, it's a consortium of all of their medical institutions there, but it's working in the community to not only, improve their campus, but to help housing, energy, food all around the neighborhood. And they've brought the government in on that. We say a lot that this process is the strategy, and it's inevitable that when you invite someone to the table and when you sit down and when you ask everyone what they see, they're bought in, right? And so when answers emerge from that, people are already together. And so, as I say, I haven't ever seen a government start it. We have alums who are working in government, but they're working on very specific projects.
Thank you, Cheryl. I have a question about back here. I have a question about San Francisco, Silicon Valley, being here in the design mecca as technology has taken off. And so design is this critical strategy part now of business and NGOs, everything across the board. So a lot of designers get caught up in the bright, shiny object and going to just solve for whatever that problem seems to be. Are you seeing that there's a shift in how designers are looking at things? Are they seeing now more about the social innovation aspects, about products and clean products? Are they waking up to that, or is that still a hard road ahead?
No, I think everybody's waking up to that, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody living in our current culture or media or environment that doesn't know that it's time to think about those things. So I think there is growing interest everywhere. Paul Hawkins, in his book called Blessed Unrest, called this the biggest social movement on earth that's happened sort of under the radar of governments and, you know, all the people who are just taking it on themselves to fix problems that they have. So, and the other thing I see is that companies are beginning to recognize that the people who work on these things, so in order to work on social and commercial issues at the same time, you have to be looking across silos within a company. And there is more interest in people who can solve problems across silos and who are generalists, right, than there ever have before. You know, in the world, I can only tell you sort of the world that I live in is growing. I don't know, and from what I know of, you know, the AIJ and other design organizations, it's really important. So I think everyone is aware of it. Some people think they can do something about it. Some people think they can't do anything about it because they've got to get that deadline and got to get the next. So it's a question not of whether they care and whether they want to do it, but do they feel the agency and do they know how?
I thought this was a great talk. I'm very excited about it. I've worked in psychology and neuroscience for about 10 years, and I've really come to a point in my life where I've tried to embody many of these principles, and I've worked on a project for the last 6 months that I do believe embodies many of these principles. And I'm at this stage of looking around and saying, wow, I actually need to work with other people in order to achieve what I want to do. So, you know, I think you've already answered this question, but I'd still like to raise it, answered it in the sense of get your master's degree, talk to people. But what would be some resources for me to seek out other people to collaborate on projects that embody these principles?
Well, the simplest way to do it is to really, there's a hierarchy we use, right? Which is you start, there's a wonderful book by Robert Fritz called Creating, in which he talks about the difference between problem solving and creating. That problem solving is making something bad go away, right? That creating is causing something that didn't exist before to come into existence. And, you know, that principle in the essential creative process is what we believe in. So if you're clear about what you want to create with this site, then it should be clear to you who it's for, what success will look like, and literally just go start talking to those people. Once you do that, and it's amazing to me in business, in all my years of business, right, the number of times that people didn't really clarify where they were going or what success was, let's just get it out there, you go around in circles. So the same thing works. You know, I would just say be very clear and intentional about who you're helping and how you want to help, and then look for organizations that are in that, you know, in that world or in that system. Short of that, you know, I just don't know the West Coast enough, but I know there are fantastic schools here with programs on this, and it won't be hard to find out.
Yeah, I really have been enjoying this talk too, but I was just wondering what your attitude is towards the idea of the genius designer who is, we need to have every so often, who comes out on their own with a great idea that is not none of us even know what it is yet, and just how often that happens and how we should support it or not.
Well, I hope we always have genius designers, and I think we do, and we will, right? I think the difference is that, they tend to make great leaps. They tend to have a unique vision. They tend to create things that haven't existed before or have ways of seeing the world that no one else does. And that's really important to leapfrog. The kind of design we're talking about is much more humble. And it has to do, it doesn't matter if your idea is new, right? If you're trying to help someone with someone and there's an answer that's been used before, great, right? So this is a really different mindset of people who like to embed themselves in whatever community, like Paul Pollack or Michael Murphy or Eric Hirschman, right? And to really understand the dynamics and create from that. So it's really different mindset, really different process. Yes, support the geniuses and honor the different perspective they have on life and what we're doing.
Hi.
Hi.
Since so many people were asking you for the resources on the West Coast, and I happen to know some, and I just wanted to list what I know for the benefit of the audience. Whoever is interested in learning more about human-centered design or design thinking, here there is a program at California College of Arts and Design, which is on the 8th Street in San Francisco. There is a company called IDEO, and they have IDEO Open Initiative, mm-hmm. where people can gather together to solve social challenges. You can find them on Meetup or Google IDEO Open Initiative. There is Stanford Design School, which have sometimes free classes, crash course in design mm-hmm. thinking. And there is also a Meetup, endless source mm-hmm. of group finding mm-hmm. for people to something yep. to do in the area.
And I'm sure there are incubators that have classes for not much money or free. Yep.
You mentioned that these are age-old questions and problems. I was just wondering from your experience and your research what you think is the greatest problem space right now from the past, and then also what you think will be the greatest problem space coming up.
I think it's probably the same thing, and for me it's just the pervasive disconnection that we have created from nature, that we are so... I did a lot of work with the World Wildlife Fund, and this is a number of years ago now, but they did research. The environment doesn't even make the top five on the list of what people care about. It is abstract to people, and it becomes more abstract all the time. So I think... if we could reconnect to nature, as corny as it sounds, so many of our problems would be solved. I work with a young guy who is a National Geographic explorer, and he and a group of friends are developing monitors for the environment, you know, for some of the most robust ecosystems. And some of my students took on a project last year to try to connect people to that, right? So in this age of the quantifiable self where everybody's got at least one monitor for, you know, their heartbeat and how many steps they've taken, to use that to connect people to how the earth is doing. And I don't have an answer. And I honestly think that will be the big issue we have in the future.
Well, I had a question. In terms of funding and how you make these things happen, do you see this as people should do things that they can be self-supporting through creating a product, partner with a corporation, use government funding, do a crowdfunding kind of thing? What's your take on the various ways to approach this, and what's most effective?
So my personal take is I'm a capitalist, and I think these businesses should be sustainable, and I'm all for-profit businesses in this space. And having said that, there are certain kinds of businesses that do not support themselves, and there's a whole lot of businesses that don't support themselves in the beginning. But regardless of the tax status, whether it's profit or nonprofit, or how you make money, you have to design into the business a way for it to sustain itself. And so, you know, I dissuade students, you know, say, what do you want to do? Well, I want to start a nonprofit. And I said, well, be prepared to be talked out of that, right? Because it's just a really hard road to hoe. And when you don't design in a way to sustain the business, you're just, the odds against you are just so much greater. And it, you know, there are companies that have demonstrated that this is hugely profitable, right? Medtronic, which is a medical devices company, is one of the most successful companies in the world. And they've been doing this forever. They recognize that in India, there are millions of people who could not afford to be tested for pacemaker, let alone afford a pacemaker. So they put their best engineers on developing a test that was affordable to people, and then developing a pacemaker that they could afford. So that's an example of a brilliant company, right? They just opened up a huge new market for themselves, and the technology that they discovered in doing that is going to be useful everywhere else in the world. So I don't believe there's anything wrong with companies making money. I think it's a very healthy thing. There's always a discussion between mission and profit, and there should be, right? That's something you should think about every day.
Well, we've reached that point in our program now where we have time for one or two more questions. Are there any more questions from the audience?
Hi, I really appreciate your talk. and I've really enjoyed the topic, so thank you. My question is about designing for scale. I really like this idea of designing based on relationships and communities. And obviously that's important for being able to find a tailored solution for a particular social scenario. Can you talk about scaling up those solutions and also designing for spaces that you don't necessarily know sort of fit the demographic that you're originally designing for?
Yeah, scale is such a hot topic now, and people are writing about it and thinking about it, and at this moment foundations are always interested in what will scale and what will scale. There are a couple of things. One is Some programs just scale more easily than others, right? Things with technology, what Eric's doing has the capacity to scale all over the world just by definition. Other things, like what Rachel Brown did with CCD Amani, there was another project that came out of that that began with a program in Chicago where it was called Ceasefire. It's got a different name now. But gang members, former gang members, were actually trained to intervene in violence. And they would literally go there, and they would literally say, Frank, you know, stop and think what this means to your mother and your sister or your brother, whatever it is. And they were looking for ways to scale it. And so they did an experiment to see whether that could scale with mobile technology. And what they found is, people in the States, not enough of them have mobile phones, right? So they tested it in Africa, and it worked, where everybody has a phone. You know, there are generally principles that will scale. They're generally sort of core principles that need to be adapted to local situations. But there are some things that shouldn't scale, and it's okay. It's okay for some things to be local because that's where they're needed and that's what works.
I had a question, I guess, or a comment. One of your comments, one of your examples was a water distribution thing in India. So it made me think, are you aware of anything that's happening in Flint, Michigan, that some of the similar concepts either happened organically or that people brought in ideas from, design for social innovation or something?
I don't. I'm sorry. I see a lot of instances where it would be the things that have been developed in other countries would be really beneficial here. But I don't know of anything specifically in Flint.
Well, speaking of Flint, I know Cher spoke out very publicly about Flint. Do you think in terms of outreach and getting people involved, for the kind of things that you're talking about, does it help to have a celebrity endorsement or a celebrity behind you to do these kind of things?
It depends. I'm sorry, there's some jokes I'm trying to get out of my head so I can talk about this seriously. You know, it's like anything else. It depends, right? There are people who excel at forming a theory and talking about it and getting celebrities to help them. They aren't always the people who are working on the ground. There are other people who are really good at working on the ground and making change and don't even know what they're doing or think about what they're doing and think about talking about it. You know, I think use of celebrities is just as it is in any other product endorsement. Sometimes the celebrity gets in the way. Sometimes people remember the celebrity but not the product. But there are also times when it is a genuine commitment on the part of the celebrity and it raises visibility in a way that nothing else can. And so I think, like everything else, it just has to be done with some thought and caution.
Okay, thank you. Well, we've reached the point now where we are out of time. Charlotte, I'd like to thank you for being here today, and I would like to remind our audience listening at home that we're here today with Cheryl Heller. Our program has been The Intergalactic Design Guide and Quantum Approach to Human and Business Potential. This is going to be part of you've had a preview today of Cheryl's upcoming book. Cheryl Heller, it's been great to have you here. And if you'd like to just give us a couple of closing thoughts to think about when we leave here and how we might try to integrate this and when we can expect your book, that'd be great.
I can't answer the one about the book. I think the closing thoughts is what I learned from Paul when he kept saying, take the leap, is that the leap is not a leap. The leap is beginning to change the way you think about what you're doing right next to you, the next step in front of you, right? And that once you're aware of things, you can't put them back, right? Once you know other people, I have I work with a woman in New York who deals with homelessness, and she developed her own approach to research where she got community members to engage in researching homeless people. And in the process of engaging with them, they found out about them. They became people. They became not, you know, other. And so she's had great success in integrating people back into housing. I would say the same thing is true, right? Just, you know, all we have to do is look. It's all around us. And be aware of that when we act. Thank
you. Okay, thank you.
I was only kidding. I wasn't going
to. I'd like to thank our speaker today, Cheryl Heller. I would like to thank all of you in our audience today here at the Commonwealth Club of California and our audience listening at home. And with this, I would like to close our program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of engaged public discussion. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.